ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit leggmason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate, Connor, and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Thank you so much for joining us. As always, I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. On the show this week is simply one of the best in the business covering ETFs, Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas, which, by the way, I think we need to come up with some sort of an ETF nickname for Eric, because Eric is always coming up with these colorful nicknames and metaphors for everything going on in the ETF space. I think Eric deserves his own nickname. So reach out if you have any ideas. I need to think about that one. But in any event, I have a bunch of different topics I'm going to throw at Eric this week. We'll talk about the biggest ETF story so far this year. We'll discuss the ETF fee war, his favorite new ETF launches, ETF flows, and much, much more. Always a blast whenever Eric's on the podcast. Really looking forward to this conversation. He'll join us in about 15 minutes. And actually, on the topics of ETF flows and biggest ETF stories this year, we're going to start this week with ETF.com's Laura Krieger to talk bond ETFs, which I don't think there's any question bond ETFs are one of the biggest stories. They've taken in something like 2/3 of total ETF inflows, and global bond ETF assets crossed over the $1 trillion mark earlier this year. We're going to get Laura's take on what's been driving this attention from investors, and also look at several bond ETFs that have stood out, both in terms of flows and performance. And then we'll close this week with Simon Lack, managing partner at SL Advisors. He's going to spotlight the American Energy Independence ETF, which owns midstream energy infrastructure companies. So think companies involved in processing, storing, and transporting things like crude oil and natural gas. Simon is going to walk us through how this ETF is constructed, how it compares to other energy and MLP ETFs, and then we'll also cover the overall investment case for the energy space right now. So, packed show. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com, or you can find us on Twitter at etfprime. Let's start by talking bond ETFs with ETF.com's Laura Krieger.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I ran the numbers again for the cheapest ESG ETF portfolio. These are good numbers. They're not marijuana good, but they're pretty good. If you believe that it's going to save you in the apocalypse, you might want to consider something else.
Laura, so I ran a Twitter poll a couple of weeks ago asking what the ETF story of the year was so far, and the pretty clear winner was bond ETF flows with nearly 40% of the vote. The other options I gave were the pot ETF race, always a crowd pleaser, low volatility ETFs, and the Precidian active shares approval, which, by the way, that got like 30% of the vote, which was a bit surprising to me. That's probably a topic for another time. But bond ETF flows, this was interesting because this isn't necessarily the most exciting topic in the world, right? So if bond ETF flows can beat out pot ETFs, I think that has to grab your attention. Do you think it's just been a perfect storm this year between the market environment and bond performance and maybe even just investors becoming more comfortable with bond ETFs themselves?
I think a lot of that is all wrapped up into the same story for sure. You look at bond ETF flows, we've had 84.9 billion in new investment assets go into the space so far this year. That's double, fully double what we've seen go into U.S. equities. And there's now almost $1 trillion in fixed income across both U.S. and international fixed income ETFs right now. So there's certainly a pickup of interest in the bond ETF space. And to me, it means just that investors are really wary right now. You know, they're looking at the volatility in the equities market. They're looking at this new normal of falling rather than rising interest rates. They're looking at a potential increase in inflation, maybe. The trade war is starting to show up in the equities market now. And a lot of very smart people are saying, you know, we might see a recession soon. And so that's pushed investors toward these safer assets. You see it, I mean, you just mentioned another corner in which we're seeing people go to a safer asset, low volatility ETFs, right? There's been a massive uptick in ETFs with minimum volatility factors, into gold ETFs. It's all, to me, kind of the same story. It's investor uneasiness with the future.
What about drilling down into specific bond ETFs? So I know the iShares 20-plus year Treasury bond ETF, TLT, that's certainly been a big story this year. Any thoughts on that ETF or some other ETFs that have stood out, whether in terms of performance or flows or both?
Oh, for sure. So a lot of the bond ETFs that are bringing in the cash are kind of the ones you might expect, right? They're the broad market approaches. The iShares U.S. Treasury Bond ETF, GOVT, that's the ticker, and the Vanguard Total International Bond ETF, that's ticker BNDX. Both of them have brought in billions and billions of dollars. You mentioned TLT, that's brought in $5.5 billion. The 7 to 10 year Treasury version, which is IEF, that's, I believe, the top gainer at $6.7 billion year to date. I mean, there aren't any big surprises here, right? Especially once you consider that performance-wise, these sorts of bond ETFs are really kind of knocking it out of the park. And that makes sense because when you have a longer date maturity, it tends to mean better performance because you have to be compensated more for holding, you know, longer dated bonds when there's more interest rate risk and prices go up and yada, yada, yada. So, it's not super surprising. One that did pop out at me, however, that makes sense when you think about it, but maybe, you know, isn't immediately obvious as to why it's getting so many flows, is the iShares MBS ETF. That ticker is MBB, and that tracks mortgage-backed securities. And I think a lot of investors my age and maybe younger came out of the financial crisis. We still have kind of this gut check of, you know, what the heck, mortgage-backed securities. But in fact, they're super safe when they're done right. And as far as bonds go, they offer extremely high liquidity, great yields compared to other slices of the market. And for that reason, mortgage-backed securities are kind of an institutional darling. So I'm not so surprised to see MBB gaining, and I think it's on the order of about $5 billion, gaining so much year to date.
What about TIPS ETFs? So I know you had a story recently highlighting some noteworthy inflows into the Schwab and Vanguard TIPS ETFs, which might be a bit counterintuitive to some investors, given that inflation hasn't really been that big of a concern. What do you think is going on here?
For sure, right? Like, I was a little surprised when I saw so many flows going into these two ETFs, and the two ETFs in specific are the Schwab US TIPS ETF, that's ticker SCHP, and that got more than $1 billion just last month alone. And the other one that saw huge flows was the Vanguard Short-Term Inflation Protection Securities ETF, that's ticker VTIP, that got another $500 million. So there's two reasons for this. The first is rate cuts, right? Investors seem to think that the Fed's rate cuts are going to lead to inflation, even though we haven't really seen much in the way of inflation thus, you know, up to this point. Now that the Fed is cutting rates again, they're starting to think that maybe, you know, inflation may be on the rise. And if inflation's on the rise, then of course you're going to want a treasury that has inflation protection built into it. But there's another factor to this too, specific to these two ETFs, which is that, you know, it's the fee war. SCHP is the cheapest TIPS ETF on the market. It has an expense ratio of 5 basis points. VTIP is tied for second at 6 basis points. You compare that to the biggest TIPS ETF on the market, that's the iShares TIPS bond ETF, ticker TIP. That has an expense ratio of 19 basis points, and it saw outflows last month. So, you know, I think there's some investors out there that are taking their money from the more expensive fund and moving it into cheaper options.
Yeah, but this whole category was just fascinating to me because we all know the Fed has had just a devil of a time trying to spur inflation.
Right.
You know, especially given the current environment, to see investors move towards an inflation hedge, that was pretty eye-opening. One other area I did want to ask you about was floating rate bond ETFs. So actually last week, your ETF of the week, though not for good reasons, was the WisdomTree Floating Rate Treasury Fund, ticker USFR. And what's interesting about this is it was one of the ETF darlings last year, right?
Sure.
This was a huge success story in terms of bringing in assets. But you noted how this thing has lost, I believe, like $1 billion in assets recently. Do you think the rationale here is as straightforward as it appears, just that investors expect rates to fall, not rise?
I think that's right on the nose, right? It has lost almost $1 billion just in the last month, $884 million. And it's because it tracks floating rate treasuries. And these are great treasuries to hold when rates are going up. But when they're going down, as you know, the Fed is expected to cut rates again later this month, you know, when rates are falling, then USFR has to roll expiring securities that it's holding into lower yielding securities, which means, you know, cruddier income for investors, which is ostensibly the whole point we invest in fixed income in the first place, right? So I think it's right on the tin as to why this one is losing money.
Are there outflows from some of the other floating rate ETFs, you know, FLOT, TFLO, or has it really been confined to USFR?
No, it's all of them. All of them are losing, you know, the senior loan ETFs are losing a lot of billions of dollars. FLOT, like you said, is losing billions of dollars. Nobody wants to be in floating rate right now.
All right. So bond ETFs so far appear to be one of the stories of the year in the ETF space. However, I'm going to pivot here. There was some big news this morning from VanEck and Solidex announcing that the VanEck Solidex Bitcoin Trust would be made available to institutional buyers trading over the counter. And what
I
was interesting,
I hear you cheering from New Orleans.
Certainly caught me off guard a little bit. My initial thought was that VanEck, as well as Bitwise, who has a filing as well, would wait to see what the SEC does in October. They have a final decision to make. But I haven't had a chance to read through every nook and cranny, you know, the press releases and everything else. I know this is using something called Rule 144A, so they're going to offer this to institutional investors. It's not going to be made available to retail investors. But what caught my attention was in the press release, they said they'd be using the standard ETF creation redemption process, which that's different than the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, as I understand it, right? That thing trades right now at like a 25-30% premium. I'm sure you're in the same boat I have. You haven't had a chance to look at everything involved with this yet, but any initial thoughts on what you have seen so far?
Sure. So if I had to say anything, I think it's probably that this isn't, I'm a little unclear as to whether this ETF is an ETF, right? So the rule 144A, what that says is that it's an exception built into the 1933 Securities Act that allows Securities to be bought and sold by certain qualified institutional buyers. There's an asset level cutoff for, you know, and a whole registration process and everything that defines QIB, qualified investment institutional buyers. But the takeaway is that these securities can only be traded between these buyers. They can only be bought and sold between these institutions. They have, you know, shorter holding periods before they can be traded. They have lower reporting standards, and they don't have to be registered with the SEC. The idea is that institutions, they don't need the same level of protection that your garden variety retail investor needs, because they know what they're doing and they know what they're getting into when they make these sorts of trades. So that's why there's this protected class of, you know, securities. So usually this rule is invoked in the case of, say, you know, individual bonds or global depository receipts, GDRs. Those are also 144A securities. I've never heard of this as a way to launch an ETF. But it's not really an ETF because it's a private placement of shares. There's a big difference there.
Well, and that's what I need to, I think, understand a bit more. You know, the other thought that crossed my mind was, why not do this for any type of investment category where the SEC won't approve an ETF? If you think institutional demand is there, why not just do a private placement on whatever the underlying asset class or investment strategy may be? I guess I'm just surprised we haven't seen this more often.
I think that's a very good question. In the case of Bitcoin, I do believe that the issuers really wanted access to the retail market. You know, there is an institutional market, but they definitely wanted to be able to bring it to the retail side of things as well. So they, you know, went the way that you would go. They go the retail channels. You go through the SEC and register and so on. This way, at least, they can start building up an institutional market. And I think it was you who tweeted earlier today that the Grayscale Bitcoin product, something like 85% of the ownership is institutions. So, you know, there is an institutional appetite for Bitcoin. And that's, I think, what VanEck and Solidex are trying to capitalize on right now. They just, if they can't get retail, fine, whatever. We'll just do the institutions for now. So
no doubt. And that Grayscale Bitcoin product has, I think I also tweeted out, 2.3 billion in assets charging a 2% management fee.
Mm-hmm.
So it is surprising that there hasn't been a competitor come in and try to capitalize on that and take some of that market share.
Well, I think now there is. Now it's, I do want to stress to the listeners though, that this isn't an ETF that's trading on a national exchange like NYSE, right? This is not something you're going to be able to go buy yourself, unless you're one of these buyers. It trades on an OTC market regulated by the SEC. So just throwing that out there, making sure everybody understands.
Well, Laura, always appreciate the insight. You know, anytime we can talk Bitcoin ETF, I have to work that in, even though we were focusing on bond ETF flows today.
Of course. Of course. You know, Bitcoin's in the new bonds. No, don't trade on that. Please don't trade on that.
Hey, thanks for joining us this week.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
That was ETF.com's Laura Krieger. All right, our next guest is the one and only Eric Balchunas, Senior ETF Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Eric co-hosts Bloomberg's ETF-focused TV show, ETF IQ. He co-hosts Bloomberg's ETF podcast, Trillions. He's also written a book on ETFs, the Institutional ETF Toolbox. And look, I know I say this whenever Eric joins us, but seriously, few, if any, cover the ETF space better than Eric does. And he's now on the line with us from Philadelphia. Eric, always a great connecting. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. And I'm curious if the cranberry zombie is somehow thematically linked to your first question.
Maybe later we'll talk about zombie ETFs. I had that thought. So look, this is going to be a lot of fun. I have a bunch of different ETF topics we're going to get into. I know we like to do this on Twitter quite a bit, but always more fun in person. Let's maybe start on a bit of a more serious note and talk financial markets and ETF flows this year, and then we can get into all of the other stuff. And clearly the two biggest flow stories in 2019 are bond ETFs and low volatility ETFs, right? Those two categories have taken in something like 75% of all ETF flows. Now, we just covered bond ETFs with ETF.com's Laura Krieger. I personally think the low vol story is pretty straightforward. So I'll start by asking you, besides those two, has anything else caught your attention in terms of flows?
No, I mean, those are the two biggest, I think. The low vol is always fascinating to me, but then when I sit back and think about it, to me, if low vol is doing anything close to outperformance, which it is, it's such a great and easy thing to sell. You know, who doesn't want the market but with a little less edge, right? So those are ETFs that are sweeping the globe. My colleague Tom Sarafagas in London is talking about how popular they are there, too. So this is a worldwide phenomenon, and to me, some of these minimum vol and low vol ETFs, and smart beta in general, this is for money that wants to do something a little different than the market. So this is where money might have picked an active manager in the past. It's now going to these types of ETFs. I will say, though, that it is interesting that there hasn't been a mass exodus in equities. I know the market's up, but the news flow has been so negative. So what we're sort of seeing here is that people aren't rushing into equities per se, but they're not bailing either. They net inflows into equities, and we think that the flows going into fixed income and gold, gold is another big story for the summer at least, maybe not the whole year. Gold and then low vol, these three areas are where people are going to sort of have more peace of mind, but without totally completely changing the makeup of their portfolios, because I think, you know, this really comes down to Trump. I think a lot of people think his policies are pro-market. The Fed is on the market side. But yet the person, the Twitter feed, makes people nervous. So staying in stocks, but then buying fixed income, treasuries, gold, or low vol equities is sort of a way to have your cake and eat it too and have some of that peace of mind and try to benefit or have a little bit of a hedge in case something erupts over there. But at the end of the day, I think the Fed having the markets back is why you don't see more shifts in portfolios.
Any thoughts on how the rest of the year will play out in terms of ETF flows? And look, neither you or I have a crystal ball. If you look just overall, the record for ETFs was 2017, I believe something like $465 billion. Last year, we had in the neighborhood of $315 billion in overall ETF flows. Obviously, it doesn't look like we're coming anywhere close to those, but how do you see the last few months playing out?
So me, I see a rush back into equities. I see something along the way is going to get the trading crowd excited. I could be wrong. Like I said, this is pure speculation. But look, equities are sort of the, you know, I hate to use LeBron James because I'm not a huge fan, but they're that player you cannot count out. They tend to make take in money very quickly. And look, if the Fed provides a baseline of support and then there's anything other that's a good catalyst, you could see equities kind of come back and start punching within their weight. Right now, they're very below that. So I think that could happen. I think that would make flows maybe in the ballpark of $300 billion, so nowhere near 2017. But, you know, up there with sort of maybe tied for the second most ever. That's something I think will happen. Again, could be wrong, but I see that happening. And keep in mind that back to Trump, I think his desire to use the market in his campaign, it's, you know, clearly one of his main themes he's running on. And whether this is like appropriate or not, I just don't see him messing with that at the end of the day. I think, you know, whether it's, you know, going against China or whatever, I see him as making sure the S&P is up will trump, no pun intended, those other issues he has going on. So he would probably back off. And so I do think something along those lines, maybe a trade deal with China, maybe it's not the biggest one ever, but it's something that good news could provide that catalyst to bring those equity investors back.
All right, one other question on flows before we move on here. I had mentioned to Laura earlier that I ran a Twitter poll a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you saw this. I was asking what the biggest story in ETFs has been so far this year. So the four stories in my poll were bond ETF flows, the low vol flows, pot ETFs, and the Precidian active shares approval. Bond ETFs won that poll with like 40%. Do you agree with that in terms of being the story of the year, or is there something else that you think has been a bigger story?
No, I mean, look, the flows, look, I just looked at the past 25 years, and there was only one other year where fixed income ETFs took in more than equities, and that was 2009. Remember, everybody was really scared in 2009, so that kind of made sense. Plus, treasuries did well in 2008, so people were performance chasing. And that was barely, I mean, it barely took in more. So this would be the first year. And right now, fixed income is outflowing equities. I believe it was like 90 to 40 billion, something like that. That's a lot of distance still. So to me, that is the story of the year. There's no doubt because it's so unusual. I think the Precidian active shares for the nerds, that's probably our story of the year because, you know, when you bring up Precidian or non-transparent active, you can put regular people to sleep. But within the ETF world, we know that this is so major because there's, what, $12 trillion in active mutual funds? And while the market has kept their assets higher and higher, and they haven't had to make real desperate moves, their organic growth is really in the toilet, right? A lot of them are seeing outflows. And so this is one way they're trying to maybe bridge over into the ETF world. And so there's been a lot of debate about whether this is the way for them to sort of move into the new world, find a spot, thrive, or even, you know, survive and thrive, or whether it's all just like it's a vain attempt like NextShares, which will just fall flat and be a flop. So to me, the details may seem boring, but what it represents is major because you've got $12 trillion of assets in active mutual funds, most of which are probably having meetings trying to figure out what to do to move forward.
Okay, so given that, what are your expectations here? Do you think the Precidian active shares, do you think this can gain some traction? Do you think investors will put their dollars into these products once they begin launching?
I'm very bearish. I'll tell you why. I equate it to a fancy new dog food bowl, maybe even diamond encrusted. It's a great structure. It's a great design. It's a modern structure. I don't take away the structure. It's, whoever thought of it, very good. We haven't seen it in action, but let's just assume it works great. The problem is what's in the bowl. Does the dog want the food in the bowl? And the flows say no, it doesn't. There just isn't any interest in discretionary active on the equity side. Fixed income, it's still there a little bit, but that's probably where you wouldn't see people use non-transparent active because there's no need to. So the equity side, I just don't see it. The bigger problem also is smart beta. There is definitely a group of people who want to try to do a little better than the market or be defensive, do value. There's a market for that. The problem is smart beta has filled that gap, and smart beta now is dirt cheap, it's rules-based, and it's tax efficient. So this would maybe tie the tax efficiency, but I doubt these will be anywhere near the cheapness of smart beta. And I think advisors in particular like the quant thing. They like the rules-based aspect of smart beta as well. So I just don't see how you could do that. So somebody will say, well, they can just move over investors from the mutual fund. I just don't think a lot of these companies have the stomach for that. That is like cutting off your own arm. Now, people who are in the Terra Dome, these issuers who are used to that, I think they are used to maybe severing their own appendages for the sake of, like, getting some more flows. I don't think the mutual fund world, especially if they don't have any experience in ETFs, is used to that kind of, fortitude to be able to do that. I don't see them doing that to themselves. But again, that's my theory. So I just don't see a road forward, whether it's BYOA or whether it's natural. I don't see either road being really that open. The only thing that gives me some hope is the names involved, Goldman, BlackRock. I mean, I wouldn't bet against some of these names, but I just don't see the road forward.
Yeah, and I think, as you know, I completely agree with just about everything you said. I'll add one more wild card, which is that there are some competing non-transparent structures that have yet to be approved by the SEC. And I wonder, you know, what happens if the Blue Tractor proposal or one of these other ones is approved? I think that may cause even more confusion in the marketplace, just in terms of, you know, what's the best structure, what should be used. So maybe that's a more of a minor point, but certainly not helping the situation. What about the ETF fee war? So I think this was easily the biggest story earlier in the year, right? We had that huge flare up in late February, early March. All of the big players were involved in chopping fees. We even saw some free ETFs launch, a negative fee ETF. JP Morgan launched an ETF at 2 basis points. But since that time, things have been, I think, eerily quiet. Now, I know you're probably going to call me out on this because you probably remember I actually declared the fee war over right before that big flare up, right after the Inside ETFs conference.
I do.
But is it possible this thing is truly over, that maybe we have reached the bottom on fees?
Yeah, it does feel a little exhausted. I'll agree with you there. Although, again, every time we've declared it dead or over, it comes back. But I think that the last fee war was interesting. It was like a 6 weeks. I can't remember. It might have been even less, maybe like a month, where both big and small issuers were all doing all kinds of things. I think seeing SoFi and the negative fee one have come out and haven't done much, didn't really work. So I don't see many of the indies following suit there. So I feel like that if they got assets, you'd probably see more of that happening. The big boys, though, I think what they're going to do is just continue to sort of trim at the margins. What I'm seeing more of is these big model portfolio makers like Merrill Lynch and even some advisors that use a lot of ETFs, if they're about to switch to a cheaper Vanguard one or a Schwab one, they'll call the other issuer they're about to leave and say, look, we'll give you a month. And I think you're going to see a lot of cutting of ETF fees out of the blue that you're like, wow, I wonder why they cut that one. It was the biggest in the category. MUB was a good example. It went from, I think, 26 basis points to like 9 or something. And that's the biggest, most liquid one of the category. But I believe they got a phone call from one of those model portfolios that can move a couple billion in one shot. So I do think you'll see some of the more traditional liquid big ones that you might just see them cut fees out of the blue. I don't know if that's a fee war or what you would call just keeping a client happy, but I think you'll see some of those. And Vanguard will continue to cut maybe a bip here and there every year, and people will probably have to keep up with that. But I wouldn't call that a war. I mean, yeah, it's just slow moving, but I don't think we'll see anything like the outbreak we saw in February, especially amongst the sort of more indie players trying to get attention. Clearly that didn't work in terms of just moving the needle. You need more than to be cheap. You definitely need to have a big brand name or something else going for you.
All right, Eric, so if the fee war is perhaps winding down, what's been won here? So I actually tweeted something last week about the fee war maybe being over, and Alpha Architects' Wes Gray had what I thought was a great response. He said, aren't there supposed to be spoils of war? Why spill blood for no reason? So I guess I'll turn that question to you. What do you think has been won from the perspective of fund companies?
Well, not much. I mean, they don't like this. Listen, all of this is the Vanguard effect. Vanguard's decision to set up the company as a mutual ownership structure is what all this is about. And the fact is, people are picking their funds, and they still take in the majority of assets. But if you copy Vanguard, you start to do well. So in a way, and Vanguard, they're not playing the game of profits, right? They're playing a different game. So in a way, all of this, I mean, if you look at every single cut, you can almost trace back to Vanguard. So Vanguard didn't go in this to have spoils, I guess. It comes back to just whether Bogle's philosophy was more about setting up something like a nonprofit or a public utility. And that's what's really happening here. So his mentality, Bogle's, of not going in to get spoils, he could have easily been probably 20 times richer if he wanted. that's what's happening, and everybody is having to deal with that because right now cheap is in vogue, and the spread of information has come out, and people realize the impact costs have on your returns, and cost they feel like is the one variable they can control for. Can't control returns, can't control the market, but you can control for cost. And I think that is, you could argue it's over-obsessed. But the demand side of this sometimes is lost because you could say, well, why would issuers keep cutting? Well, because it works. And the demand side is something you don't hear a lot about, but this is what people want. And the question is, where is this all going to go? And my theory is it's going to look like the airlines. You have three gigantic companies, one Vanguard, one BlackRock, one probably like a combination of like five of them, are all going to compete on, you know, serving everything to everybody at, and they're going to compete on fees. And then the other ones will be these more niche, like these airlines that do like Alaska Air or do something very specific, you know, private jets. Those will be the alternatives, the hot active managers, those strategies that do something really unique, like a USO. Those things are going to live on the fringes and be able to charge more. But I think everything in that middle zone is going to end up being just pretty much free, probably 0 to 5 bips. And so, yeah, I'm not sure. But Wes Gray operates in that fringe area. He's basically trying to serve up something that can do much better than the S&P, has a lot of brain power in it. And what, you know, again, I always say that active needs to do things you can't index, because if you can index it, it will be indexed quickly and turn into beta.
We're visiting with Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas. Eric, besides the fee war, there is another war that seems to be flaring up. Cash wars, right? I know you've been covering this. This is companies like Fidelity and Vanguard, along with Arobo, so Wealthfront, Betterment, et cetera. They're all competing over the yields being offered on the cash in clients' investment accounts. And the question I have for you on this is, look, for some of these companies, cash is the sweet nectar. That's really where they make their money. So I believe around 60% of Schwab's revenue comes from net interest, just as an example. So with this focus here, this competition, what happens to some of these firms? Because the money has to come from somewhere, especially with the robos. I'm not even sure how some of these companies are making money to begin with.
Yeah, no, this is a fascinating point. And it's interesting how, to me, this is just, again, you know, I call the ETF industry the terradome. And I think some people look at the terradome as this thing off in the distance. But to me, it's just the future. It's just the future hasn't hit you yet. And, you know, whether it's selling data and terminals, we're all in this gigantic ecosystem together. And I don't see it not hitting anybody. And so right now it's moved over to cash. And instead of being lower, higher is better. And ironically, you know, the cash wars that are coming out, I think were somewhat in response to the Schwab move of coming out as a cheap advisor to the point where they had this Netflix subscription fee that amounts to something like 6 bips a year. Anyway, whatever it is, it's very low. And a lot of people pointed out, well, they make you have a certain portion of your money in cash, and on that cash you earn way less than you could in a money market fund. And so I think that got people talking about, well, our advisor charges a little more, but we will give you more for your cash. We'll sweep the money into something that earns more. And I think Fidelity picked up on it. And then what's funny is that all Vanguard has been doing it all, the whole time. I mean, they put you in a money market fund that earns pretty much more than anybody on the list. But this is a logical sort of evolution of the fee war. And it's interesting. So it goes from ETFs maybe to broader mutual funds. Now it's coming to advisors to a degree. And then from advisors, it's going to how much you earn on your in your cash. And it'll just keep going around until it covers everything, I think. And right now it's on the cash wars. But how much this moves the needle, I'm not sure. It's hard to get data on this. But I guess we'll see, at least in terms of advisor and their assets of these big advisors like Betterment, you know, Vanguard, Schwab. Will this matter? And Schwab's the one to watch because they've obviously been very cheap. But they're the ones who you don't earn as much in your cash. And their latest advertisement, I believe, put out a number that was higher than what you earn on that required cash account. That number was just what their money market earned. So there's going to be some, like, I think some interesting ways they phrase things that you got to ask. Is this what I earn from cash automatically swept here, or is this what their money market offers that I have to go buy actively?
Well, the other thing too is our teaser rates, right? So I think it was RIA Biz that had a piece on this last week. They were talking about how these robo-advisors will eat basis points on the cash because it's actually cheaper than their typical customer cost of acquisition. And they have these VC firms funding this all anyway. So, you know, from a dollars and cents perspective, they'd rather just offer a higher rate than maybe what they would otherwise, just because it's cheaper to get customers in the door. But I just think if you look at the numbers, I gave the Schwab revenue figure earlier, this could actually be more brutal than the fee war overall, depending upon how competitive it gets.
Yeah, and like obviously for some companies it matters more. Schwab probably the most impacted that I can think of. But yeah, it's certainly an interesting development.
All right, Eric, we have just a few minutes left. I have to ask you about this Spy Kids story, which created a ton of buzz. And for people who haven't heard about this, there was a Bloomberg piece a few weeks ago that explained how the Spider S&P 500 ETF, so SPY, SPY, that's the largest ETF in the world with like, $260 billion invested. It's also the most heavily traded security in the world. So it's structured as a unit investment trust. And because of that, it has a termination date, which is January 2118, or 20 years after the death of the last of 11 individuals who were named on the trust. And I thought the reaction to this story was priceless. So there were people speculating that maybe BlackRock or Vanguard would hire an assassin to pick off these 11 individuals to get SPY to go away, right? This would definitely make for a good movie. But Eric, you actually had an opportunity to interview several of the so-called spy kids on your Trillions podcast. I'm just curious, what was that like? I just thought this was such a fun story and not one most people had heard before.
Yeah, it doesn't have a ton of consequence. I think, you know, SPY gets, you know, traded, bought, and sold every day, no big deal. This would not impact that, but it is a juicy story. And my colleague Rachel Evans and Tracy Alloway wrote this story, and it was, I give especially Rachel credit for contacting these kids, getting them on the phone, getting them to talk. The fact that they had never even heard of it was fascinating to me. And so getting to interview them, we just basically asked Rachel and to see if some of them could come on. And so we got to talk to them, and they were great. I mean, they were, you know, you just seemed like people I work with. They were millennials, very nice, upbeat. They were laughing about it. They kept wondering how they could get paid from this, though. They thought, you know, and when Rachel first reached out, they all thought it was some, like, Nigerian print scam because they heard, $250 billion. You've been named in the document. And it does sound kind of fishy. And then once you accept it as reality, I think a lot of them started to recognize that Amex and Spiders, because they remember going to the Amex as kids. They were the babies of people who worked at Amex at the time. So then they wanted to know if they could make any money on it. The whole thing was really just a fun story of how sort of archaic UIT structure works, which isn't used anymore. Only a couple ETFs at the beginning used the structure. Then they merged over to the open-end structure, which is what most use now. The UITs can't do securities lending, can't reinvest dividends every day. So there's more legit investing reasons that you should know about UITs versus open-end funds. This one was not of consequence, but just probably the most fascinating reason. And we got to interview Nate Most's grandson, Alexander Most. That was really interesting. And we, a lot of them hadn't really heard much about ETFs, but Alex Most invested in ETFs, he said. So we asked him which ETFs he held, and, you know, total blasphemy, he said he owned VU. That was the only ticker he gave us, and I just thought, oh, my God, your grandfather is rolling over in his grave right now because, you know, he invented SPY. You really should be in SPY. I thought that was really kind of funny and ironic, and just said a lot about the state of things as well.
Yeah, this was just a great story. I knew SPY had a termination date, but I did not realize the situation with the 11 kids. So that just made for a neat story. All right, Eric, let's close with a few rapid-fire questions, and we'll need to go quick here, so I'll just rattle these off, and you can answer how you see fit. So first, your favorite ETF launch so far this year, and to be clear, this is not an investment recommendation.
Oh, man, you got me on the spot with this. Let's go with, for some reason, Nerd is sticking out in my mind. You know, I like the video game space. This one is probably the most purist, so I'd have to give it to this one. There's a couple of marijuana ETFs that launched as well that are intriguing to me, YOLO and Toke as well. Those stick out, but there's been a lot of good launches.
Yeah, I think the video game space, when you see a 16-year-old kid when, what was it, 3 million playing Fortnite, that has to get your attention.
It hasn't translated into flows quite yet, but again, I still think this is still very early. We watch this space closely.
All right, which ETF expected to launch over the next several months most has your attention?
You want to go Bitcoin?
We may need another 20 or 25 minutes to get back into that with this morning's news.
Well, here's one. The First Trust ESG, it just launched, actually. The First Trust ESG ETF, which is charging 95 basis points, has fascinated the whole team. We have now studied First Trust almost like an aberration from like the laws of flows, because they seem to be able to take in money no matter what. And I think First Trust shows that you can sidestep the Vanguard effect if you have really aggressive salespeople, really strong relationships. So that one is one to watch. If that gets $1 billion, that will just be, I think, if you're looking for somebody out there to like beat the Vanguard effect, you should be looking at First Trust, because they've done it time and time again. But can they do it with an ESG ETF charging 95 bips? This is the ultimate test for the First Trust situation, to see if they can pull getting assets off into that.
All right, since you mentioned Bitcoin, you cracked the door open for me. And so I've got to ask you about this news I mentioned from this morning. I also asked Laura about it earlier. So VanEck and Solidex announcing that the VanEck Solidex Bitcoin Trust would be made available to institutional buyers. I gave Laura the same sort of out. I haven't had a chance to look into every aspect of this, but any quick thoughts on that news?
Yeah, I mean, two things. First, it sounds like it will just be like another GBTC. Limited shares trading over the counter at a high premium. What good does that do the world? Not much, in my opinion. However, it has been proven over and over that if you could just get the genie out of the bottle with something the SEC might be nervous about, just get it out. You know, usually they will work with you rather than trying to stuff the genie back in. I think MJ was a great example of that. Now YOLO. I mean, there's, you know, so I do understand where they're coming from. Just get something going. Show the SEC it's okay. It's like a baby step. It's risky, but, so far, seems as though the SEC has been rewarding the mantra of it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. So I totally get it from their point of view. I don't know how much it will. It's not an ETF, obviously, right? Because it's not trading on an exchange. You can't do creation redemption with it. So I just be careful the media doesn't call it an ETF.
Well, interestingly, in the VanEck press release, they said that this would handle standard creation redemption. But again, I haven't had a chance to read into this thing. This is using something called Rule 144A. I will say, and I mentioned this to Laura as well, you know, if you have an investment strategy or some asset that you want to be made available to institutional investors and you can't get an ETF approved, why wouldn't everybody try doing this, right? You can wrap anything in this, take advantage of this rule and launch a product and then maybe hope to convert it over to retail at some point. I don't know. This is going to be interesting to watch. Eric, lastly, give us your Philadelphia Eagles prediction for this year. I always have to ask you about this.
It pains me, 8-8. I just think we married the wrong quarterback. I got that feeling. Nick Foles was the perfect fit. Okay, maybe he wasn't as exciting, but he just fit the team better. And I don't know. I fear for the worst. For some reason, all the Eagles fans here do not remember last year in the regular season. I think we were like 6-8 under Wentz or something like that. Then Foles took over. Foles, every time he gets the ball, we start to do well. And when Foles has the ball, when it's 3rd-and-8, I feel a sense of calm. When Wentz has the ball, I feel that typical Eagles impending doom feeling. And that's just visceral for me. So I hope I'm wrong.
Are even playoffs? Wild card?
So.
Division? Really?
Playoffs and it becomes a whole controversy here. That's my. I'm just telling you how I feel. It pains me to say this as a fan. I hope I'm wrong.
Do you want to offer a Chiefs prediction as well? Obviously, here in Kansas City, it's Super Bowl or bust with Mahomes. What do you think happens?
Yeah, I mean, 12-4, Andy Reid rules the regular season, but then you probably get bounced in the first or second round. Sorry. Look, this comes back to me being an Eagles fan under Andy Reid. I call him the great almost. Nobody does almost as great as he does.
Well, and I think we saw that last year, although I don't know that I can blame that AFC title game loss on him. Eric, always a blast chatting. I really appreciate everything you do covering ETFs. Thank you for joining us this week.
Likewise. Always a pleasure, Nate. Thanks.
That was Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas. And if you're not already doing so, highly recommend following Eric on Twitter. All right, let's go right to our ETF Spotlight.
It's time for the ETF Spotlight, where each week we highlight one exchange-traded fund. There are thousands of ETFs available to invest in. ETF Prime has sorted through them all, so you don't have to.
The ETF we're spotlighting this week is the American Energy Independence ETF. The ticker symbol on that is USAI. And now joining us to discuss this ETF is Simon Lack, managing partner at SL Advisors, the issuer of this ETF. Simon founded SL Advisors back in 2009. Prior to that, he spent 23 years at J.P. Morgan running derivatives trading and overseeing more than $1 billion in J.P.'s hedge fund business. He's also the author of two books, The Hedge Fund Mirage and Bonds Are Not Forever. Simon is on the line with us from Westfield, New Jersey. Simon, a pleasure having you on the show this week.
Thank you. Good to be on the show.
So, Simon, let's just jump right in and walk through the details of this ETF, and then we can get into the investment case and everything going on with U.S. energy production. Explain the construction here. What exactly does this ETF hold?
Well, it's an index fund, and it's invested in the most representative index of midstream energy infrastructure. So, traditionally, master limited partnerships have been how people invested in pipelines. But the industry's changed a lot over the years, and master limited partnerships or MLPs are a smaller part of it. So it holds a lot of corporations. And we're invested in pipelines, storage assets, all of the physical infrastructure that sits between the oil or gas well on one end and the ultimate customer at the other. So all the infrastructure that makes that work.
And Simon, for people who are unfamiliar with the energy space, can you maybe also explain the upstream and downstream segments of the market,
just
for comparison?
Yep. Upstream is basically drilling, so exploration, production, E&P is upstream. Midstream is really everything from gathering and processing, which is the infrastructure that takes the oil and gas as it's produced, processes it, stores it, and moves it. And then downstream is the ultimate customer, whether that's a refinery, could be a utility burning natural gas or an export facility.
And then how many holdings are typically in the ETF?
Around 30.
Okay. Now, the other aspect of the energy sector that I do think can get somewhat confusing for investors is when we start talking about MLPs and general partners of MLPs. What are some basics in terms of how these compare to just the stocks of energy-related companies?
Yeah, it's a little confusing. The good news is it's gotten a lot simpler in recent years. So for a long time, you had MLPs, which were basically these vehicles that held the pipeline assets. And then they'd have a general partner that basically managed those assets. And it's a lot like the relationship between, think of a hedge fund and a hedge fund manager. And in fact, we always favored investing in the manager of the assets, the general partner, versus the MLP itself. It sounds a little complicated. The good news is that almost all of these have now simplified and collapsed. So the general partners combined with the MLP. And so now you have corporations on the one hand, partnerships on the other, mostly corporations. They just look like any other corporation. The partnerships that still exist continue to issue a K-1 instead of a 1099, which a lot of investors don't like. But the sector has been simplifying in order to attract more capital and be more accessible to more investors.
If you look at the breakdown within the ETF between partnerships and corporations, what does that look like at a high level?
Well, we have around 20% of our index in partnerships. If you do market cap, it's probably a little bit more than that. But the sector is overwhelmingly corporations. Well over half of the market cap of midstream energy infrastructure is now corporations.
All right, so let's talk investment case for USAI. Year to date, I believe USAI is up something like 14% total return. Crude oil is up about 25%. Nat gas is down 22%. Give us the investment case for midstream energy infrastructure.
Well, the shale revolution is the most fantastic success story for America. I mean, it's allowing us to become energy independent, which is why we named the fund after that. And so we're now exporting crude oil, we're exporting natural gas, we're no longer dependent on OPEC, on the Middle East, on unstable regions for our oil. And in fact, American energy independence and the shale revolution is probably the biggest story in the energy sector in the last 5 years. And so we're investing in a segment that really benefits from growing volumes. And as long as volumes continue to grow, I think the outlook is very good for the pipeline sector.
How close do you think the U.S. is to becoming fully energy independent?
Yeah, it sort of depends how you measure it. If you measure it on a crude oil basis, which is how people often think about it, we're still a net importer of crude oil, but not a lot, 1 or 2 million barrels a day overall net. But there's a lot of different grades of crude oil. So we still export a lot because the refineries that we have prefer, or they're set up to handle the sort of the heavy sour crude that we tended to always import. So there's hundreds of different grades of crude oil, and there's a lot of two-way flow between the two of them. If you look at natural gas, we're already natural gas independent. If you look at it on a total energy basis, a BTU equivalent or energy equivalent, we're already energy independent. So I would say we're there, but traditionally when people think of energy independence, they think of crude oil. We're close. I think we could be there within 5 years.
Simon, going back to USAI, obviously there are some other ETFs available to invest in this space, particularly MLP-focused ETFs. What do you think are some of the most important considerations as investors evaluate all of the different options here?
Well, the huge thing to consider is whether the fund you invest in is a RIC-compliant fund. And there's a lot of MLP funds, mutual funds, and ETFs, which are poorly structured because they have a corporate tax liability. They actually pay corporate tax on their returns. It's very, very uncommon in the ETF business. Nobody really thinks of their ETF as having to pay corporate taxes just like a corporation. But it happens if you have more than 25% of your portfolio invested in MLPs. And so most of the MLP ETFs and mutual funds out there do that. So critically, make sure that you're in a RIC-compliant fund that keeps MLPs below 25%. And doesn't pay corporate taxes. I think that's really vital. After that, I think you want one that's broadly diversified. Our index is the most diverse, broadest, most representative index. And I think you want to invest MLPs that are still controlled by a general partner. We hold a few MLPs. There are still some out there that have a general partner that basically calls all the shots and has a lot of preferential economics and information rights. And you want to avoid those. Anything that pays what are called IDRs or special payments to the general partner. So diverse, minimize MLPs in favor of corporations. Make sure that your fund is not subject to corporate taxes. That's really important. Big drag on returns in an up year.
Something else I noticed when looking at this ETF is I understand it, it owns some companies involved in renewable energy. And it also excludes companies involved in coal-related activities. And, of course, there's a lot of buzz around ESG investing right now. I guess, one, is that correct in terms of what it owns? And then, two, do you view that as a differentiator?
Well, we do exclude coal because we think it's a dying industry. And we do have a sleeve for renewable businesses. We don't own any pure play. It's actually tough to find companies that generate consistent profits from renewables today. But we do have businesses that include renewables within their portfolios in terms of what they do. And so it's an area that we think is going to continue to grow in the years ahead as renewables grow. You know, we're not wedded to fossil fuels. We're wedded to energy businesses that generate reliable cash flows. And as renewables start to play a bigger part, that'll be reflected in the composition of our index and our ETF.
All right, so given that composition and given that many investors think income when they think of MLPs and the overall energy space, do you view this ETF as a yield play? Is it a bit of a growth play? Both? How should investors think about this in the context of their portfolios?
Well, I mean, it's a really interesting time because energy is very out of favor. I mean, the energy sector as part of the S&P 500 recently dropped down to 4.5%, extremely low. And you get 6 to 7% yield on the sector. But the valuations are so depressed that I really think investors should expect some kind of price appreciation or growth as well. So it sounds sort of the best of all worlds to say, well, you get yield plus growth, but I really think that that's what investors should be looking for when they invest in this sector. Very attractive yields. And in fact, payouts are increasing this year for the first time in about 5 years, and free cash flow is increasing for the sector as well. So I think the valuations are really compelling and cash flows are clearly growing.
Well, Simon, with that, we'll have to leave it there. Excellent spotlight this week. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Ned. Appreciate it.
That was Simon Lack, Managing Partner at SL Advisors. Again, the ETF is the American Energy Independence ETF. That'll do it for this week's show. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit leggmason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, I'll be down in Arizona attending WealthStack, which is a new conference focused around the future of investing and financial advice. There's going to be a tremendous lineup of speakers there from all across the investment industry. And so ETF.com's Dave Nottig and I will be doing several interviews while we're there, and we'll play that audio for you on next week's show. Until then, have a great week, everyone.